Hey gang, it's Paul Burish. Stay tuned for another exciting episode of Tube Talk, coming up next.
The following program is brought to you by the producers and the sponsors.
This is 1330 WRCA Watertown, Boston.
Welcome aboard, ladies and gents. Tube Talk starts right now.
Let us sing a song of
Yes, happy days I hear again. We haven't started the show up with that one for a little while, folks. Lou Levin, 1929, and you know, what did he know? He thought we were just pulling up out of that depression, you know? 10 long, hard, slogging years, but fortunately, an era graced with great radio shows, great radios, great engineering and technology, the heyday of American radio manufacturing at its zenith, as we like to say. And you found Tube Talk. If you wish you could go back in time to the great old days of radio, let me tell you, people, you can. Every Friday, 10 p.m., WRCA 1330. Be there or be square. And as Ready Kilowatt says, listen to Tube Talk. It's a glowing idea every Friday night. That's what he says. My pal.
A fine romance with no kisses.
A fine romance, my friend. This is, we should be like a couple of hot tomatoes.
But you're as cold as yesterday's mashed potatoes. A fine romance, you wrestle.
A fine romance, you won't nestle. I might as well play bridge with my old maid aunts.
I haven't got a chance.
Ain't this a fine romance?
A fine romance, my good fellow.
You take romance, I'll take jello. We two should be like clams in a dish of chowder.
But we just fizz like parts of a sedlitz powder. A fine romance with no clinches.
A fine romance with no pinches. You're just as hard to land as the Ile de France.
I haven't got a chance.
This is a fine romance. In my blue serge pants,
I never get the chance.
This is a fine romance.
A fine romance indeed for a fine program like this one we have right here called Tube Talk. Martha Tilton and Johnny Mercer. A Jerome Kern composition, that's from 1946, orchestra ably led by Mr. Paul Weston. And friends, let us remind you that Lehigh guaranteed pre-tested radio tubes are your tube for quality, performance, and dependability. Every individual tube must undergo rigid tests before it leaves the Lehigh plant. This guarantee of pre-testing is but one assurance of the best buy from Lehigh. Oh, I love that rhyme. Rugged construction, dependable performance. Yes, friends, this is all provided to you at an economical price as well. It makes our tubes even more desirable. Compare performance, quality, and price with any standard tube. And remember, Lehigh tubes are fully guaranteed. Each tube individually boxed, 50-cent handling charge on orders under $5. Save with a 5% discount on orders of 100 vacuum tubes or more. All orders shipped COD, prices subject to change without notice. From your friends at the Lehigh Electrical Company, 412 Halsey Street, Newark 2, New Jersey.
Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that. Two different types of artistry. Artistry and rhythm. Stan Kenton. And then we have Artistry and Western Swing by Tex Williams and his Western Caravan. Tube Talk is very pleased to have Joe Rossi joining us tonight. Joe is a regular participant on the famed Philco Forum and is a radio detective of sorts, and we're very happy to have him here with us tonight. We're going to solve a little mystery. Joe, thanks so much for coming on. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
And, you know, just maybe before we get going with our topic tonight, main topic, you can give us a little idea how you got interested in antique radio. From what I understand, you know, you made mention that your dad kind of got you started in the hobby. How did you get involved to begin with antique radio?
Well, when growing up, my dad had his workbench in our basement in Detroit, and he had all these radios, all these parts and things, and I don't know, just as a nosy kid, I went down there and started, hey, these things have numbers on them, and so I started sorting all the tubes by number, and then my dad would work on radios. People would give him radios. Of course, back then, they weren't antiques. They were relatively new.
Now we're antiques.
Yeah, well.
That's the way
it goes. I have had people call me that. So I would stand watch him, and there were times when he would allow me to do some of the soldering or desoldering. And he had taken a NRI, National Radio Institute course back in the late 40s on the GI Bill. And so he had graduated from that, and so he thought it would help him in what he was doing, which was he worked for Michigan Bell Telephone, and it certainly did.
That's great. You know, I have a good friend whose dad was very active in ham and antique radio, and he worked for the phone company as well, so it was a great crossover because, you know, he's a technician, so he had, you know, good with his hands, good with the, you know, testing tools, good with... you know, all the basics that would transfer over into electronics, and he had a great radio room. So it's a great, kind of like the little boy who goes fishing. You know, you watch your dad do all that stuff, and it's great that you can keep the interest up on that. He'd be proud about that. So I'm going to ask you though, there's certain brands or types of radios you like to collect. I mean, is there anything special that you always seek out, or are you anything that strikes your fancy type of guy?
Well, the first one I had was a Philco 37. 660, and there's 630. I still have that. It's a console and a very, very nice radio, and that's how I stumbled on the Philco Forum. And but right now I'm working on a RCA console. It's from the late 40s, and it was my grandmother's.
Oh, very nice.
And so it's I'm doing the replacing the filter condensers and all that good stuff with it. But yeah, I see something and I say, hey, I like that, and that's generally how I do it. I don't specialize.
Well, you know, RCA made some great stuff too. So once you get that one going, I'm sure you're going to have some fun with it. Now, our topic tonight, this is kind of a detective story of sorts, and to be into radio, especially if you're into any of the lesser known brands or older sets, you know, a certain amount of detective work goes into figuring out, what do you have sometimes? It's not always as easy as, you know, I'll find a nice RCA 6-tuber from 1947, and I can see it's a 56X5, and it's got a clean, you know, tube outline on the bottom of it, and because it's an RCA, it's in all the, it's in riders, it's in everything, and there's no mystery behind it. Now, you did a good deal of work trying to sort out the mysterious Plant A radios, and you start out the little story you sent me here. You said you don't like unsolved mysteries, and you had owned a set named a LaSalle, and you thought it was pretty cool looking, and you know, it just had this orange and black plate on the chassis and a bunch of patent numbers, and was manufactured in Plant A, and you couldn't find a schematic or get any information on it, so I guess you got aggravated and you got rid of it. But it's kind of set you out on this quest here. So maybe you can give us a little idea here about how you got started in your hunt for what was Plant A.
Well, again, that's, you know, I've seen on some of the blogs where folks have been speculating about it.
Right.
And then when I'd seen the exact radio online, I saw a picture of it. Somebody had one that I had. And I thought, my goodness, that was a nice radio. I sure wish I'd kept it. And not that long afterward, I was on a radio or a website called Radio Attic, and there was a radio on there. It was called the Crusader, and it was the exact same radio. So that sort of got me started on this. I'm thinking, okay, somebody private labeled this, and I began to just search the internet for Plant A, and later on finding out that there was a Plant C. I just took it from there.
I even saw a guy, there was a Plant P, and I saw a tag that a fellow had, I don't know if it was on the Antique Radio Forum. So, I mean, you have all these mysterious plants. And, you know, you mentioned the Radio Attic, and the Radio Attic Archives in particular is a great resource. I know a lot of folks will go over there looking for things, and as they've sold radios and people have sent in photographs that Steve has got up there, I mean, I've found some fairly obscure things. A True Test radio I saw over there. I was trying to figure out who made True Test, and I don't know if that's a Plant A or not, but again, it's one of these brands that, you know, you see once in a blue moon and you scratch your head, but it's great, you know, that Steve's got some visuals over there. Now, from what I could determine here, you've got three main theories on the Plant A, and one involved the Radio Manufacturers Association, and maybe that you know, this label represented some type of a pool patent, and how did that one kind of hit your mind?
Well, that one was actually, and these theories that I've got here were ones that seemed common on the internet.
Uh-huh.
Folks speculating about what the Plant A stood for, and one of the theories was that the Radio Manufacturers Association assigned those plant letters as part of a patent pool. But looking into that, I contacted the successor to the RMA. It's gone through several evolutionary names, but it's currently, I think, called the Electronics Industry Association. And they had no record of that, of having done that.
I see.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's an interesting theory, but I was able to say, nope.
That's a dead end.
They never did it. It was a dead end.
Now, your second one you had mentioned in there is that somehow a company was acting like a patent enforcer for RCA, and that the Plant A labels were some kind of a tracking mechanism or device for them. So how did you kind of get onto that one?
Well, again, that was another theory that was being, or that some people held to, is that
kind of floating around.
Yeah, it was a way that RCA could track the number of radios, that they would have somebody as a patent enforcer, and they would go around to each factory and make sure that that, you know, they were getting their fair share of the cut, if you will.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
hey, it's their patent, of course.
Oh, sure. You know? Yeah, I mean, and that was a big deal for them. And Sarnoff was he was a tough guy when it came down to the dollars and cents and the contracts and that whole scene. Now, you know, the other thing that's kind of interesting about this is, you know, we were talking about these mysterious radios. I have a book. This probably goes back to the maybe early 40s, that somehow I managed to get out of a Historical Society book sale, and it's from one of the laboratories over at RCA. It was written by a fellow who is a professor over here at MIT, not far from where the show is on, and it's sort of this history chronicling a lot of developments in radio and the radio industry. And he has some numbers, you know, and again, in his day, where he had access probably to all these companies and information was easier to get because it was current information. You know, he has production figures and information on a lot of the major manufacturers, but, you know, you don't even get into some of the smaller manufacturers. And, you know, I think about it, just how prolific radio production was in the country, you know, not to get off topic here, but there's a very, very significant amount of effort and labor and materials going into making an awful lot of radios for companies that, you know, the common you know, the common consumer may never have heard about. So, you know, as we were talking before we got on the air here, I mean, will we ever be able to figure out how many radios were actually made at this Plant A, or labeled Plant A or Plant C or Plant P? Probably not. But Chicago, where this whole story is kind of centered around, was a hotbed for manufacturing, and a company out there that I believe you sort of settle on here is the most rational and likely solution here is that it was the Clinton Radio Company that was the maker of Plant A, you know, based out in Chicago. And you know, it's easy to see how they could blend in out there with all these different companies. So what kind of turned you in the direction of thinking it's Clinton?
Well, that was really the third theory that was going around, was that Clinton was the generator or the producer of the Plant A, Plant C radios.
Uh-huh.
And that came from Alfred Gherardi, I think is how his name is.
Yep, I've seen those books, yep.
Yep. And if I can just move my chair here, Radio Television Handbook. I have like a 1942 edition.
Very cool.
He lists in there all the, under Clinton, all these subnames, all these for the either model numbers or the company name.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something like 22
Yikes.
Names that he lists. So I thought, well, this guy is closest to the source than us speculating here in you know, 2014.
Sure.
I went back and began looking up Clinton and looking up those other names.
Yeah, and you know, just to go through a few of them here that are, you know, all likely candidates, Plant A tag candidates here. Some Federal, Empire, True Tone, Climax, Zephyr, Sonora eventually comes into the picture a little bit here. Aetna had the Factory P, I think. Monarch is in there. So, you know, there's lots of different names that, you know, people might be familiar with. And, you know, it was interesting, too, because, I mean, I guess that's a little confusing. In some of the research, you know, that you were doing there, I was reading that people would tell you that you might have a factory that's, you know, this. And to get an idea of the scale of some of these buildings, if you've ever seen, you know, like a picture, I've seen a picture of the Zenith plant on West Dickens, I believe. Mm-hmm. These are humongous facilities. And, you know, so you might have a company that might use a slightly different name or street address or one side of the street for one product it makes or a different side of the street because they're trying to figure out, you know, how many people like this, so maybe if they send in the mail or they're looking for information, they'll contact at this address. And, you know, where there are so many different radio companies in Chicago, I'm just going, like, what a maze, you know, to try to figure all of this out.
Yeah. Where Clinton was located, 1217 West Washington Boulevard, Chicago, it was, and I haven't been able to tell how much square footage it had, but it was a three-story building, and it was a fairly large building. But the addresses that were assigned to that were 1217 through 1227. And you'll see, looking through old radio magazines, when advertising, you'll say, why does this company have this address here and this one, a different one, someplace
right,
else?
Right.
And that's what they would do. They would say, reply to this, and then they would know what magazine that they had seen it, and so where to put their advertising dollars.
That's interesting. You know, and I Googled that up to look. I did a street view, you know, for that street address.
Yeah.
And you could kind of get a sense that, you know, in that area, at you know, the layout, I mean, it's big open space, and, you know, I'm sure they had quite a facility there. And, you know, I was relating to you a little earlier in a chat we had. I tried to do some detective work on finding some information on a True Tone, and a friend of mine, basically, you know, he just did grunt work. You know, he kept looking for pictures of different True Tones, and he sat with my radio in front of him for I don't know how long, and he eventually got me a lead on it. So, I mean, you were researching on some of the forums, and I guess you were working with a friend who's been on the show before, X-Ray, Bill Meacham, down in Vieques in Puerto Rico. He provided you with some photographs, and, you know, so lots of different people were involved in your hunt. Who else gave you a lift, or where else did you find, you know, sources of information on trying to tie this all up and tail it back to Clinton?
Well, Well, one of the companies that was located at that same address was a company called Rextron, R-E-T-R-O-N. And Radio Today, which was a very, very popular dealish magazine of the time back in the 30s, listed them as a maker of radios. And to this day, I haven't been able to find a picture or a reference. And I know you're familiar with the Radio Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And they had nothing on radios. What they did have was something about a company called Rextron who made tubes. So I reached out to Jim Cross down at Vacuum Tubes Incorporated, and he got me in touch with Ludwell Sibley, who wrote a book on tubes, on antique tubes,
yep.
and offered some help in that respect, trying to find that. Alan Douglas, who is a just a marvel, he's written many books on antique radios, on test equipment, and he helped me out with one of the other companies involved at that address, which was Earl Weber. And so, yeah, Michael Felt from Indiana Radio.
Yep, this is a familiar name. Yep, he has a great website with a lot of great radio dial artwork on it.
Yep, and of course, Bill Meacham. And when I reached out to the Consumers Electronic Association, which is now the latest version of the RMA, it was Kerry Donovan, who is their research consultant at that division. And so, I mean, a lot of folks... I reached out, and they were happy to reach back and offer help and encouragement.
That's great. You know, we're just going to hit the pause button here for a brief bit and remind everyone this is Tube Talk on WRCA Radio 1330 AM. Our guest is Joe Rossi. Our topic is the mysterious Plant A, which is getting less mysterious as we go along here. I am your host, Paul Burish, and, you know, you mentioned Alan Douglas, and... he's a member up here in the New England Antique Radio Club, and I saw him back in February at the we have a big Westford meet up here, East Coast meet, and he had some stuff with him. I didn't even know what it was. You know, he has some very unique devices and stuff that's associated with radio. He's a fascinating character, and you know, always willing, you know, to discuss what he's got with him. And it's like a little history lesson, you know. So, I mean, you can always go by and, you know, check out somebody's radio table. But he always brings something very interesting, and he's a great resource. So I'm glad. I'm not surprised at all that he could help you out.
He's one of the ones that if you can sit and listen to, that's, you know, you need to get the information he has.
Now, most of these sets that Clinton was making, you know, would fall into that sort of house brand radio category. Are we safe to say these were things marketed through independent stores or smaller labels, people who, you know, couldn't have their own facility? So Plant A was the producer and Clinton was the power behind it all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you were mentioning that some of them are pretty basic stuff. You know, they're not, you know, the fanciest sets, but that there were some of the consoles that were pretty neat looking and had bigger tube counts and were pretty decent stuff. I mean, is there anything out of Plant A that the audience might be more familiar with or less familiar with based on it being a bigger number, you know, something that was produced in larger numbers than some of the smaller labels that came out of there?
And trying to get those production numbers, and referring back to our conversation earlier, you know, it's hard to get even what RCA produced or GE produced.
Sure.
It's easier to find some numbers, but the best I could come up with is by about 1935, about a million and a half radios had been produced in the United States. But which part of those were Plant A or Plant C or any of the others, I just
hard to say.
Hard time. But again, you know, with Plant A, Plant C, they're going to have that metal label in the back. Plant A was a red or orange and black label. The Plant C was a yellow with black lettering, and Factory F, I think, was silver with black on it.
And they did make some things for some of the you know, larger names in radio at the time. I think you mentioned in there that they had some stuff that went into the Silvertone line. Mm-hmm. And Ward's Airline, which was very popular, and you see a lot of their stuff around. So there were even though they were producing for a lot of the little guys, they had some big customers there. I mean, Sears and Montgomery Wards were big sellers in those days.
Oh, yeah. And one thing about that LaSalle radio, it's very possible that the LaSalle auto brand was giving those away.
You're very true, yeah. Yep, LaSalle.
And I say that because my dad's parents had a LaSalle.
Yeah, I can...
That radio came out of their house. I'm speculating again, but I mean, it's certainly a possibility.
You're putting the pieces of the puzzle together. I can see Archie Bunker, GR Old LaSalle ran great, you know. So the names from the past, you know. So it's very interesting stuff, and it sounds as if you narrowed it down, and you solved a good chunk of the mystery for people. Now the question I have to ask is, though, did you ever come up with a schematic for your old LaSalle?
No. I didn't. In my more advanced years now, if I had the radio, I could probably just figure it out and do the fixing myself.
Sure.
But back then I was a kid, and it was, you know, what did I know? But no, the schematics, you couldn't find them in Riders, and you can't find them in the Sylvania database or any of those. They were pasted. They were like little sheets of paper, and they were pasted either inside the cabinet or underneath the cabinet. And as I said, as we had discussed earlier, it was really an awful place to put them, because inside the cabinet, they heat up,
right?
They dry out and crack. And the ones underneath, well, you know, if somebody spilled water or something on the cabinet, you know, that was gone. So, very, very difficult.
And, you know, that's so, in itself is sort of a maddening phenomenon, because for the person who likes to preserve the labeling with their sets, you know, it's one thing if you're stripping and refinishing a set and it's got a good label, you know, you can get some tape and some plastic and cover over the label, and you just kind of try to work around it carefully, and you can save it. But when you go into the inside, I remember I went into the inside of this little Philco cabinet, and it had a little tag in there about the cabinet, and then it had another tag, and they're so dry and crispy that it's almost impossible to just even touch it, you know, with the thing not wanting to crumble, and you just, there's not a heck of a lot you can do with it sometimes. There are nice little things you'd like to save. I was able to remove one from a Strongberg Carlson cabinet that was at least in one piece, but it was starting to go, and I managed to lay it on a small sheet of paper that I had cut the same size with a thin coating of Elmer's, and I just, you know, like a wallpaper hanger, gently just sort of brushed it over and, you know, put it under some books, some weight, got it some, left it alone for a little while. And, you know, it will be okay when I put it back in the thing. But, you know, these little clues that could vanish, you know, if somebody's just, you pull that chassis out and you start rumbling around in that cabinet a little bit, that label's out, that label's crumbled, it should blow away with the wind. And, you know, it doesn't do too much in the way of solving any mysteries for you. Now, Sonora comes into the picture towards the end here, and they were a company that, you know, we hear a lot more about. And especially with their little Bell logo and a lot of the smaller radios, and they were big in the portables. And they're a Chicago company. Now, they kind of come in at the tail end of the Plant Day story. And what happens with them? Did they merge or buy Clinton?
Yeah. Sonora, president name was Joseph Girl. And he, his company purchased all the Clinton assets at 1217.
Mm-hmm.
And he also, and you'll forgive me, I have, I'm at loss. He bought another company. It was in New York City.
Uh-huh.
And he merged all the assets. So all the production facilities were brought together. And at the time, which was around 1938, he was on record that he wanted to really ramp up production. They had like in 1939, he'd purchased Clinton at the end of 38, he obviously couldn't do a whole lot with it in the next year. But 1939, he had sold $40,000 worth of radios. Now, I mean, we think $40,000 now isn't a whole lot, but
sure,
back then, that was still a lot of money.
Yeah.
And by 1940, his production had gone up five times. It was $200,000 that they sold.
Yeah, and, you know, by acquiring those two companies, Clinton and his New York asset there, he, just basically bought himself a whole lot of production capacity, and he already obviously had designs and engineering, and he had concepts and lines that he could support with that, and kaboom, that's probably one of the reasons that you do see sizable numbers of Sonoras around. And I've seen an article, I think in Antique Radio Classified, there's a couple of guys who specialize in the Sonora stuff. So very interesting story.
Richard Arnold specializes in that. And up until 1940, Sonora was using to plant a plate on the back of some of their radios.
To further confuse somebody, you know, if you put them in a room with all this stuff and said, you know, you get back to me and tell you what you think, you know, they'd still probably be scratching their head a few years later if they didn't have all these great folks who are willing to pitch in and give you some info and, you know, just the natural deductive reasoning. You know, you're the Mr. Sherlock Holmes of Clinton Radio. So, you know, this is all great talk, too. And as the weather turns colder, this is all good stuff to sit around in front of a big console with a nice warm dial and a cup of coffee in the cozy parlor. And you can chat about this stuff until the cows come home. So, Joe, I just wanted to say thanks so much for being on and enlightening us tonight about the Plant Day mystery. It's a great topic to go over and go over at the meets and talk about up on a cold night in Michigan there. So thanks so much for being on. We appreciate it. Have a great night.
Thank you, and you're very welcome. Glad to be on.
Okay, thanks. The theme from The Untouchables is done by the Nelson Riddle Orchestra. Tube Talk sends out a big thank you to our pal Joe Rossi, one of the swell guys over at the Philco Forum, a regular contributor, for shedding some light on the mystery of the plants out there. Clinton Radio, it turned out to be, huh? We should have known that all along. Thank you.
never cared much for moonlit skies. I never winked back at fireflies. But now that the stars are in your eyes, I'm beginning to see the light. I never went in for afterglow or candlelight on the mistletoe. But now when you turn the lamp down low, I'm beginning to see the light. Used to ramble through the park, shadow boxing in the dark. Then you came and caused a spark that's a coral on fire now. I never made saw rainbows in my wine, but now that your lips are burning mine, I'm beginning to see the light.
I'm beginning to see the light. Joya Sherrill singing with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. Does it get much better than that out there? I don't know. Almost time for Tube Talk to disappear for this week. And I know, as sad as a thought that could be, you just got to hang in there. We'll be back next week. Every Friday night, 10 p.m., tell all your friends who love vintage radio. This is the place to be, 1330 a.m., over the air or over the net. We are here for you each and every week, friends. And, you know, just radio events are always coming up these days. And go to nearc.net. That's NEARC.net. New England Radio Club's got an event coming out. Check it out for more details on our club website. Thanks for listening, gang. Have a great night.
Stands on golden sands and watches the ships that go sailing somewhere beyond the sea. She's there watching for me. If I could fly like birds on high, then straight to her arms I'd go sailing.
He made the night a little brighter. Wherever he would go,
he would go.
Ago. His snowy hair was so much whiter beneath the candle glow.
Candle glow.
The old lamplighter of long, long ago. You'd hear the patter of his feet as he came toddling down the street. His smile would hide a lonely heart, you see. If there were sweethearts in the park, he'd pass a lamp and leave it dark, remembering the days that used to be. For he recalls when dreams were new, he loved someone who loved him too, who walks with him alone in memory. He made the night a little brighter. Wherever he would go,
he would go.
The old lamplighter of long, long ago. Stars at night are all aglow. He turns them on when night is here. He turns them off when dawn is near. The little man we loved of long ago.